this is an opportunity for us to ask questions of Dr. McGilchrist, and it would be helpful if you put up your hand, because we've got two roving mics, and what I'll do is I'll try and pick two people at a time, so we're getting the mics to move to you, so we don't have delay. Okay.
Thank you so much. Really, really appreciated all that you've spoken today
for us.
I think this is a question. You would think, would you not, that I would think and hope that the church organisation of the church, or maybe the word organisation is problematic, that we would be right brain. We have responsibility for the sacred in so many ways. There's no lack of beauty on the whole, and we have some of the most amazing stories humankind has ever heard. And yet, we find ourselves preoccupied with the lack of money. We are very thin on the ground now, less than ever before. And I think there's an element of control in the organisation that takes right hemisphere thinking and working away from us. So we're very controlled by left, in other words. Now, I can't possibly ask you what should we do about it, but I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that. Thank you.
Thank you. It's obviously rather sad that this is the case, but it's hardly surprising because, in a way, it's a reflection of the whole society. We're all suffering from this. Doctors suffer from it, teachers suffer from it. Vastly excess, over-controlling algorithms, procedures, box tickings, assessments. Safety this, safety that. I just don't know how we ever got by without it, but we seem to do rather well. It's deadly, and I think that all I can say is that it should go to the top of our agenda to reduce this effect. So I actively think that we should be looking not how to increase bureaucracy and administration, but how to reduce it drastically. When I say drastically, I mean by about 50%. That means a lot of people will lose their jobs, but the money from that can be put to having priests and doctors actually do what priests and doctors do rather than what their managers tell them to do. So, you know, The right hemisphere thing is the living experience of being a professional, from being a priest, being a doctor, being a teacher, being a lecturer, whatever it is. And this is all under attack now. And the lives of people in these general jobs are being made so unappetizing that we can't recruit people anymore into them. You know, it may not be easy to find ordinance, but you can't find doctors now. You can't find people who want to be nurses or even policemen. Because they see what happens to them. They have no freedom to do anything. They're completely bogged down in red tape, basically. So if that's at all like what's going on, you're not alone. But it is a really important thing that you've raised. I mean, I think it's, you know, that and AI are the two biggest threats, actually, to the proper functioning of our society. We're becoming strangled by rules and procedures, and, you know, we should be saying, why are there more of these? Get rid of them, you know. What about trusting people? And I know that sometimes people will let you down, but they will do whatever procedures you put in. You know, 99.99% of doctors are nothing like Harold Shipman, but because Harold Shipman once existed, now all the decent doctors' lives are made miserable by having to jump through hoops and so on. And it still won't stop some rogue being that person in the future, because there always will. The fantasy notion that we can make everybody perfect is ridiculous. We can't. What we need to do is maximize the skill and the creativity and the wisdom that come from the people that are in our organizations. And so to encourage you to feel freer, to feel more imaginative, more capable of taking responsibility would be the first sort of way I'd look at it.
Ravi, and then Paul.
So my question is more sort of philosophical, theological. I'm over here.
Where are
not
you?
That it matters. But hello there.
Oh, hello, hello. So
you were talking about consciousness as that which underpins everything. So is that God? how would you see the is that what we is that the theory you were describing, what we call panpsychism, which is a word I've heard people use?
There is panpsychism, but it's an interesting concept that is means different things to different people. So one of the problems is that the very analytic left hemispheric way in which we now think means that, so how do we put all this together? This has got consciousness, this has got consciousness. How do we combine all these consciousnesses? It is actually called the combination problem. But most problems are created by the way we start out on this process. Consciousness is not little bits of stuff in things. Consciousness is the field on which all these things exist and out of which they come. Now that, whatever we mean by divine, is certainly not going to be separate from this consciousness. But I never think that we can talk about God in terms that restrict what God can be and cannot be. God is not to be defined in language. And so I believe that it is a divine cosmos. I believe it's a creative cosmos, one that is run on the energy of love, the creative energy of love. And that, of course, doesn't at all exclude that there is enormous suffering. And somebody at the tea break was, you know, talking about the problem of theodicy. How do you justify a God who allows these things to happen? I mean, I haven't got an answer to that except to say that it's inevitable that if God is love and is to love, then love is a relationship. It just can't exist in nothing. And so there must be something other than God. It's this business of creating a space for something other to reciprocate the relation. And if that other is truly free, then that other has to be capable of doing things that we realize are very damaging. But if God were to control it, it would diminish everything about us. We wouldn't be free beings at all. What would be the point in the creation at all? Everything was known already to God and controlled by God. And you know, what's all this about? It doesn't lead anywhere. But the advantage of thinking the way I think, that there is something that is not separate from God, but is other than God. I'm very keen on making the distinction between a distinction and a severance. We nowadays think that if we distinguish between things, then we must be saying they're severed from one another and entirely separate. But often they're mutually dependent. And so the distinction is still important, and it doesn't imply a severance. So we are not separate from that field of consciousness. Nothing is. And therefore, presumably, neither is God. And when I talk about the values of the beautiful, the good, the true, the holy, whatever it is, these seem to me to be the divine aspects of the cosmic consciousness. And it's those things that are so basic, so essential, so than which nothing more fundamental can be, that they are what call to us and make our lives meaningful. Not that we invent them, but that they are there and they are the reason for our being here at all. I don't think I've answered your question.
Paul, and then Ian Parrish, and Lawrence over here, and John.
Okay, my question is maybe a bit more mundane than those high theological questions. Sorry, over here.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
In recent years, the last couple of decades, mobile phones and social media have had a massive impact on society and on individuals.
Yes.
How does that fit in with the left brain, right brain, and what effect has it had in terms of affecting the way we think, the way priorities are left brain, priorities are right brain, and so on?
Well, you would probably imagine that on the whole, although there's something rather splendid about all this, there's a lot that's regrettable. I used to say, but I've been made to think again about this, that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with technology. It's just how we care to use it. So the ends to which we put it and the ways in which we use it make it good or bad. But in a world that is severely lacking in the wisdom that our forebears had, and in which we seem to understand so incredibly little, because, as I say, the left hemisphere doesn't really understand anything. It's largely deluded. Having more and more power to do more and more is extremely worrying. Then we come to the impact of social media on attention. It's attention is the most important commodity, if you like, that we have. It's something incredibly valuable, and it's monetized and stolen from us by firms who wish to make money out of fragmenting our attention. And it's now, I mean, I'm not claiming to be saying anything new, but we do know that people's attention span has got shorter, and that people are not willing to devote deep, thoughtful time to things. They're not willing to be peaceful long enough to come into contact with and realize certain aspects of life. So it clearly does have damaging effects. It doesn't only have damaging effects. It can have positive effects. It can bring certain things closer to us. But that's not necessarily an unmixed blessing also. So I don't want to be too Luddite, but I do think that if it... unless it's cut back, unless it stops intruding into schools, unless parents are more willing to say, no, actually we sit down to a meal together and we look at one another and we talk with one another. You know, a meal is at the center of the rituals of the Christian religion, and it's not an accident, because these meals are how we bond with one another. The whole idea of a family is the gathering around a table. So it should be absolutely forbidden to have a mobile phone in school or at table. And generally, we should rely on them much less, and generally, we should try to increase people's attention spans, because it is very worrying. I hear from people at universities that they can't really expect their undergraduates who are, say, 19, 20, to read a novel through, you know, Dickens, or read a book. They just give them little selections and say, well, try to read that if you can. I mean, how are we going to get anything deep out of that? I'm worried.
Ian, and then Lawrence.
Ian? You spoke briefly about the journey of the soul, using a metaphor that likened to a river with banks, and I presume with eddies and brooks and waterfalls and rolling over cobbled stones. I wonder if you could just expand slightly, that as we eventually end up in the ocean and those dark depths of the unknown, what does that look like, and what does that spiral emerge into?
Okay. Good question. I see everything as a flow. And this is what Heraclitus, 600 years before Christ, said: everything flows. And that doesn't mean that everything changes, which is a much simpler idea. It means that everything actually flows. So it's not like a succession of goods trucks, and it's not just that there's mutability. It's that actually everything is a continuous flow. That's very important. What are we? We are like an eddy in the stream. While that eddy is there, it is photographable, it's absolutely real, it's measurable, it can move stones, and if you get caught up in it, it takes over your movement. So it's perfectly real. But it's not in the river, because it is the river at that point. It's not something alien in the river, it is what the river is doing at that point. And then when it flows into the sea, it becomes part of the sea. And whatever it was that was in that whirlpool is now going on a different journey, which is into the sea. And the sea also has waves, but waves are not in the sea. The sea waves. The sea is producing waves that are part of its being. And we see them, and they have immense power and force. They're very real, but they're just really another way in which the water expresses itself. So I see our lives and our being as like that. And one advantage of the image is that also it shows that however many the streams are, as it were, there is an ocean which connects everything. And when we think about our consciousness, I sometimes think of these little animalcules that have pseudopodia, you know, these extensions of the membrane that jut out. And these outpouchings of the membrane of the cell, if you were in one, you'd think you were completely isolated, because everywhere you looked, unless you happened to look at the sort of 2 degrees of the whole thing at the bottom where it connected with the main cytoplasm of the cell, you'd think you were isolated, but actually you're always in touch with the main cytoplasm of the cell. Those are some images that help me.
Lawrence, and then John, and then Leslie.
Apologies, I'm not quite sure why my hand went up. I don't think it was right hemisphere, left hemisphere. I think it's something in the back of my mind.
You've got an extra hemisphere we don't have.
Which we must remain open-minded about.
If we must, yeah.
It's a question much in line with Ravi's, I think. I've really enjoyed your book, Master and His Emissary, and in it you're writing about oxytocin. And I'm just wondering what sort of link in the world of love and the world that God created that you might see how that relates to our living. And if it's something that we've created as animals, you know, as a sort of self-defense mechanism, or if you see it as having some other function.
Well, whatever it is mysterious. I mean, how is it that a chemical, whatever the chemical is, can produce a feeling? How is it that a few pounds of sort of greyish-brown blancmange in here creates the experience of love? We don't know, but my strong belief is that it's not something generated by us, and that people get very excited about certain chemicals and pathways and so on, and you think that as a neuroscientist I would welcome that, but I sort of do and I don't, because I think the mistake is to think that this explains something, whereas it doesn't actually. It just gives us something extra to explain. How does love relate to this chemical? But the love, whatever it is not limited by a chemical or a neurotransmitter or a circuit. These are simply ways of describing a vehicle that helps to form whatever it is that comes about, to shape it, to permit it. William James has a brilliant... has so many. I mean, he's one of the most brilliant men that ever lived. But he has this extraordinarily good image of my voice. What is it? It's produced by my larynx. What is my larynx? It is an obstruction to the airways. And if there wasn't that obstruction, I'd have no voice at all. But the air comes through, and it's the shape of what it comes through that creates my voice. And so what we are is not the bits that shape, it's whatever it is that's coming through us. And I hope we all in this room have had that experience, that whatever it is that's happening at certain times is coming through us, is using us, but is not generated out of us entirely. Obviously we have a part to play in that, but I think it's unavoidable in the spiritual realm, in the artistic realm, in music and in so on, many other things, to feel that something is working, playing through you.
John, and then Leslie. This is Pam and Andrew.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm over here. Hi.
Thank you.
I've had a really interesting day, but I slightly need cheering up a bit now. So the reason I need cheering up is I've heard from you a very nuanced account of the brain, and what I've heard is a far less nuanced account of where you think we are in Western society. And I've heard one or two hints in a couple of your answers, and maybe things you said earlier about where there might be cause for hope, to use a Christian virtue word that I don't think I've heard from you today. Is it in the arts? Is it in Eastern cultures and societies? Are there some other places in Western society where you think there are signs of the kind of living you're encouraging us to live actually happening?
Well, I'm sorry I didn't talk enough about hope. I read something wonderful recently which has stayed with me. Hope is not the conviction that everything's going to be all right. Hope is the belief that everything, including suffering, has deep meaning. and that I cleave to. I call myself a hopeful pessimist in that I see things going wrong, largely, but it's a fool who knows or thinks he knows what's going to come, because as Niels Bohr said, prediction is very difficult, particularly when it concerns the future. And so I'm not entirely without hope. And one of the things that gives me most hope is the young people who come to talks I give and who respond very warmly and openly to what I'm saying. They themselves feel frustration with what their elders are telling them about the bankrupt sort of vision of the world they have, and they want something richer than that. So I think that is good. I'm not sure the arts may recover some of their power to move, but they'll have to do so by becoming less explicit and cognitive. A lot of art is conveying a message, but an explicit message that could have been probably better written on a piece of paper and given to me. But I don't need a work of art to tell me that kind of thing. I need it to engage with me viscerally and tell me spiritual things that can't be said other than in this kind of a way. Art lost that for a long time, but I think it's getting it back. Modern music, I mean art music, is better than it was. So things are moving in that direction. I think there's a lot we could learn from the East, but unfortunately the East, at least in the form of China, is becoming the worst example of all the things that I abhor about the West. So that little door of hope, which I gave at the end of The Master and His Emissary, has been closed in the 14 years since I wrote it. So I think that what we have to do is realize that we're not asked to solve all the problems of the world. It's grandiose to suppose that. What we have to do is do the best we can with the life we've been given. And a great friend of mine is Satish Kumar. I don't know if any of you know him. He's a Buddhist monk who is important in a place called Schumacher College in Devon, founded by E.F. Schumacher and Krishnamurti. And it follows the principles of very much a kind of ecological way of thinking, a spiritual way of thinking. And I was in Bristol with him a month or so ago, and I'd spoken, and he said, that was great what you said. And I said, well, I feel impassioned about it because we've got so little time. Mm. And then I said, and I've got so little time. And he said, but Ian, why do you say you've got so little time? And I said, well, because unlike you, dear Satish, I believe I'm mortal. And he said, but of course you are not mortal. None of us is mortal. Why are you fretting about this? It is all in the hand of God. We don't understand a tiny part of the plan that is working out here. And it's not our job to do so. But he's a very good man to all that are around him. And I think that's a light, a shining light to me. Stop thinking we're so grandiose we can cure the world's ills. We have to go the way the world goes, but do the bit that we can to further everything that we think is important. That's what we can do.
Leslie. Okay.
So, thank you very much for a very fascinating day.
Can you stand up?
No. I'm here.
Oh, okay. Yes, thank you.
Hi. Thank you. I was going to ask you a question about buildings and churches and materiality, but I'm not going to. I moved to ask you something different. Happily talk to you about that afterwards if you like. So I fully agree, you know, with you and Gandalf that, you know, we are only here to do the best with the time we're given and so on and so forth. But part of what we're given is we're given a sense of understanding power and how power works in our world. And so I wanted to ask you a question about power. Now, people tell me that when we face the coming, the present catastrophe that's happening around the world in terms of our environment, there is a conscious effort by those in power to displace our sense of anger and anxiety and our willingness to do action, to take action, by making us think that responsibility can be held individually for these things. If we all individually use less plastic, if we individually, you know, recycle our waste and so on, all will be well. In reality, of course, that's unlikely to be the case, because power does not reside in this world with us as individuals. I mean, I take your point about the 3% and so on and so forth. But, you know, that's the reality, if you like. So applying that to the larger questions that you have raised so interestingly today, how do you think we best respond, not merely, and I use the word carefully, not merely as individuals, but collectively as a church that for 2,000 years has tried to speak truth to power?
Thank you. Yes, very good. And of course you're right. I mean, you're 100% right about problems like recycling plastic and so forth. Not that we shouldn't do it, but there's something far more than that is required. And it needs to be taken on board by the vastly powerful organisations that have got us into the mess in the first place. So I'm 100% with you on that. What I think I was referring to was more that, yes, these are the problems, the practical problems that the left hemisphere, which is very interested in power, can help us address through organisation, through managing and bringing organisational skills to bear on tackling these problems on a larger level. But I've been at pains to say that this is not enough. That's all. That actually we can do what we like with that, but it will all add up to nothing, really nothing, unless we rekindle the spiritual light that should guide us. And that in that we don't need other people to get together and tell us what to do. We can start from ourselves and then get together with other people who feel like us, and, you know, maybe that's what a church is. But I'm just really saying those are two slightly different things. One is in the realm of where the left hemisphere is a useful servant, and the other is in the realm where the right hemisphere is a powerful master. Thank you.
Pam, and then Andrew.
I'm Pam. This is quite a short question. Although we know that we can recall from our memory, I've never been told exactly where our memory is.
I didn't hear it, did you?
Where is memory?
Oh, right. Nice one. Thank you. Yes, yes. I seem to have misplaced it. Yeah. The more we know about memory, the less we can be certain about this. You know, when I was in medical school, there was a clear story about the hippocampuses and certain kinds of memory at any rate. But we now know that memory is stored in all parts of the body, in fact, in the body frame, in the muscles, in the gut, in the heart, in many, many ways, as well as in various parts of the brain. And so memory is really a very interesting aspect of consciousness persisting. So it may be another phase of consciousness in which certain things that once created by consciousness have a power to linger for a while, rather like a smoke ring, you know, that you can blow, and it's there it is for a while, and then it eventually disappears. So what we do leave traces, but where exactly they leave the traces is less certain than it used to be, and perhaps it doesn't too much matter where exactly it is. You know, I was taught, and I think it's true, that autobiographical memories are more served by the right temporal lobe and less autobiographical, more public kinds of informational memory stored in the left temporal lobe, but now we know it's not just in the temporal lobes and so on, so don't know quite how to answer your question.
Andrew behind. And then John.
Thank you. When I saw that the title of your latest work was The Matter with Things, I knew straight away I was going to have to read it. it's always worried me that we make things out of things, and in the Christian context particularly, that we make God into a thing too easily.
Exactly.
I was worried about that when I was at vicar school at theological college, so I made a point of diving into the section of the library called process theology. And two things happened. One, I found it was the dustiest, most unused part of the library.
Shame.
And yeah, And secondly, everybody at the college at the time was saying, well, that's process theology is a complete dead end. You're wasting your time. I tried reading, you know, Whitehead and Cobb and people like that. Yeah. And at the time, I felt none the wiser. But it seems to me that I'm sure that's due to my, you know, lack of knowing where to fit that information and knowledge and ideas and what to do with it. But it seems to me that in the matter of things, you've managed to create a framework from your multidisciplinary approach into which to take some of the great fruits of process theology and bring them back to life again. Do you think you've done that? And how have you done that? And what is the importance of process theology, and why had it become such a dead end in conventional thinking and theological work?
Well, I didn't know really that it had, because I hang around with a lot of people who think it's terribly important. I think, you know, Whitehead he's a difficult philosopher, but I think he's certainly one of the two or three most important philosophers of the last 100 years. And I think his vision is amazingly sophisticated and answers better to my sense of reality than most other philosophers. But I would put him with Bergson and with William James, who also, I think, have this kind of a vision. And it seems to me a living vision, not of things arranged in hierarchies and boxes and categories, but of a something that flows and develops and is generative and creative and responsive. And so I've always found it very important. So I can't account for quite why, except to say that perhaps the reason dust gathers in theological colleges is that, maybe a bit unkind, and I don't know, obviously theological colleges differ, but maybe there is a danger, isn't there, of a kind of dogmatism in church matters, where people aren't really willing to open their eyes and ears to something that is not what they were taught. But I think it's important to listen. And what I think I have done, yes, is, you know, I wasn't trained in process theology. I found process theology because this was my theology. And I thought, crikey, other people have thought this too. And that's always rather reassuring, because I haven't just got it from someone else secondhand. I kind of invented the wheel for myself and then found, here's somebody who thinks wheels are good as well. So we're in business. So that's how it happened. And I don't know whether I'll succeed in regenerating interest in this way of thinking. But all I can tell you is an enormous number of people from all walks of life seem to respond to this for me. So there we are. Here's to it. Yes,
John,
yes.
John, then Will.
I wonder if you could say a little bit more about flow, particularly as regards time. And most of us here, like everyone else in our culture, is most of our life is governed by the left hemisphere's take on time, all broken into bits and all highly accountable, and we think we can always have more of it or less of it or save it. Yeah. I wonder if you could say a little bit about how we can recover the right hemisphere's take on time and how we might subvert what's basically a monolithic culture of control.
Okay, how long have you given me there?
2 minutes.
I mean, time is absolutely central and fascinating, and I was reinforced in my belief about that by the physicist Lee Smolin. I don't know if you know his work. He's a very, very distinguished physicist in America, and he wrote, I can't remember the title of the book, Time Regained, I think, or something like that. But in any case, he's exceptionally good on it. And most of the ways in which we have traditionally thought about time involve what I think are simple errors generated by a left hemisphere processing. What the left hemisphere does is take time as a thing and then look back on it once it's completed, whereas in fact we only experience time as something in which we are flowing forward. And when we represent it and retrospect on it, we've already turned it into a left hemisphere entity, which can be carved up in certain ways. But you can't, much as you can't create a line out of points, but if you have a line, you can find a point in it. Time is not made up of instants, but you can retrospect on time and say at that instant. This is all going to be very abstract, and I wonder if it's better for another time. I don't know, but I could talk for quite a long time about this. I wrote a chapter about time, and another one on flow, and they follow one another and are very much related. You know, there are these interesting paradoxes about time, like the unexpected examination. So the teacher says at the beginning of the week, there'll be an unexpected examination this week. And now the smart aleck knows that it can't be on Friday because by then it would be expected. So it would have to be on Thursday, but by Thursday we would know it can't be on Friday, so Thursday's the last day it could be. And so you see you work backwards from the end of this process. Looking back, you make it impossible for there to be an unexpected examination. But we all know that if you don't think there is one and go, ha, 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 you'll be caught out on Wednesday when the exam happens. So, you know, and there are lots of interesting paradoxes about time, but they all are based on this idea that it's a geometrical thing. We visualize it as a line, and we retrospect on it and carve it up, whereas in fact it is a seamless thing in which we live and move and have our being. And our being is one of flow. So it's central to my philosophy, those two chapters on time and flow in part three of The Matter with Things.
Will, and then Rosemary.
Thank you. Artificial intelligence is all the rage these days. There's been this conference in Bletchley Park over the last couple of days, and Elon Musk telling us that AI is going to remove the need for anybody to work. I wonder, you've already said that it's, if you like, left hemisphere writ large, to paraphrase. But what my wonder and question is whether artificial intelligence is actually intelligence?
Good. It isn't. I call it, you know, artificial information processing. That's really all it is. Can't conceivably have intelligence, because intelligence means understanding, and it can do lots of things. It can't understand them. And that's not a limitation on where we've got with AI. That's intrinsic to AI, because to understand things, you'd have to have a body, you'd have to have emotions, you'd have to have relationships, you'd have to know that you could suffer and experience it and know that you're going to die. All these are what enable us to value things, understand them, and to know how to act. So you can't program this into a computer. Amazingly, a lobster has a process of little grids that enable it to grind up its food. And they are fed by just 11 neurons. And for 30 or 40 years, people have been trying to model how it is that it uses these, and they haven't succeeded. Now, if you can't model a lobster using 11 neurons to get its food, you can't model us with billions of neurons doing all the amazing things we do. So it's not intelligent, and it is a worry, because I think the key is that it's making us like machines, not making machines like us. And it's also eating up one of our most precious commodities, which is time. Time is our life. And it's hilarious, this thing about we won't need to work. I mean, that's a worry, actually, because work is one of the things that fulfills a human being. Ora et labora, work and pray. These are how we should be. But what happens is, do you remember when, those of you who are as ancient as I am, when you were growing up, we worried about what we'd do with all that free time once computers did everything for us. Have we got more free time? No. We've got much less free time. And guess why? Because of computers. Because computers have taken over jobs. So instead of being able to ring up somebody and have a 5-minute conversation and sort it out through common sense, I spend the whole morning going around the computer in M.C. Escher-like self-referring loops, and then end up ringing a call center, if I'm lucky, in Bangladesh, which will either be answered by a bot or will be answered by somebody who behaves like one, because they've been told to behave like one and they're not allowed to have the job unless they do. So all human values, all fellowship, all common sense is gone. And instead, our time is being eaten up by trivialities which waste our energy, waste our vitality, and waste the spirit.
Rosemary.
I was wondering how the right-left hand works in the scenario of making a decision. Because if you have to make a decision, your left-hand logic might say to you, this is the most loving outcome, even if it's logical. And then your right hand might say, well, my gut instinct is
something else. So would you advise actually following your gut instinct?
Sometimes. I always say that people, intuitions are very important. Don't believe people who tell you you shouldn't have intuitions. They can lead to the specially designed problems by psychologists which will lead you to make the wrong decision by intuition. But there are also things called optical illusions created by psychologists which make it impossible to believe what your eyes are showing you. But I don't know anyone who, after seeing one of these, said, well, that does it. I'm going to live my life with my eyes shut from now on. Intuitions are our eyes. But I always say people intuit better if they reason well, and they reason well if they have better intuition. So we need these things to go hand in hand. But on top of that, it's not that the right hemisphere is irrational and the left hemisphere is rational. The right hemisphere contributes extraordinarily important aspects of reason and is just as capable of reasoning as the left. It doesn't do certain kinds of rather banal systematic procedural reasoning, but it does do rather more important reasoning of the kind that leads to great mathematical and scientific discoveries, which are very much dependent on a combination of gestalt, imagination, intuition, and, yes, reason. So we need both of these things, and a wise person is one who can, in fact, calibrate these things. And when we make decisions, we should rely a lot on our unconscious mind. This is why we often say I'll sleep on it, because in that state, our unconscious mind is able to bring a whole host of things to bear on answering this problem that our conscious mind rules out, because it's saying, so it's like this, and if I do that, it means that. But actually, you're missing the other 100 things that are around the fringes of that you're outside your field of focused consciousness at the moment. So actually allowing your unconscious mind to make complicated decisions, solve problems, you know, see a course of action, calibrate the morality of a situation. The unconscious mind can do this very well, and a lot of that is better received in the right hemisphere than in the left.
Stephen.
Hi there, just behind. Really great for one of my big takeaways today. It's going to be your real emphasis encouraging us to attend to meditation and prayer and stillness. And you've really framed that for us, I think, around talking about relationship. I'm also conscious that you said a couple of things around, helpful things around how we deal with uncertainty and hold that. And you briefly mentioned about how we deal with or need to go beyond propositional truths. And so I'm really interested in the context of our relationship with God. How does he speak to us? What do we do with the role of scripture and prophecy? And I was interested in your word on imagination and whether that links particularly in the area of, say, prophecy.
There's another good but enormous question. How do we allow God to speak to us? I don't know. I'm not quite sure quite where to tackle this question. I'm not quite sure what you're asking. What do I think about prophecy? I think it's possible. Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to answer exactly?
I suppose thinking really on the axis of certainty and uncertainty.
Yes.
You know, what are the things that we can, in relationship, that how can we know the things God does say to us?
Well, the way we know how anybody means what they mean when they say to us, which is by attending to it and bringing our faculties to bear on it. But I think particularly in relation to God, I can only speak from my own very meagre and untutored experience. But I think it's a matter of bringing the whole of your being to bear on a listening, on an openness, and seeing what comes. And sometimes things arise that we call coincidences, or things just where there was a block becomes something that releases it. And I can't begin to tell you how God works. I mean, that would be the definition of stupidity. There is no answer to that question, and each of us has our own way of knowing. But I believe that anyone who is completely certain about these matters is a worry. The world would get by much better if people were more willing to accept that they may not know everything. Einstein wrote a letter to the Queen of Holland and said, very few of us are gifted with the kind of intelligence that will allow us to answer more than a very few questions. And it would be a much nicer world if more of us realised this.
We've got time for two or three brief questions. There's Andy, Caroline and Jeremy.
Just building on the question that you've answered in regards to rest, at the beginning of creation we have that wonderful picture, and on the seventh day God rests. From a medical perspective and how our left and right brains are, how do we rest and what would be a good pattern, and how do we do that in a world that is 24/7 and busy?
Yes, a difficult question. I mean, we have a toxic society, and in a toxic society, people will become ill. I think the reasons that there's so much mental illness is because the whole way in which we believe we should act and the way we think and the way we talk to one another is fully deranged, and all those really important relationships that I've talked about have gone. But they are themselves things that restore us. So being in company, laughing, talking, loving, is a kind of way of restoring oneself. Being at peace in nature is a way of restoring oneself. And I increasingly find that just spending time in silent meditation or prayer is a way of restoring ourselves. What is not restoring ourselves is to slump in front of the telly and rest that way, because that's really a kind of empty, it's like empty calories. It's not really going to do any good, and it could make you rather fat.
Caroline.
This isn't so much a question, because I think you've answered some beautiful questions today. Hello.
Hello.
And especially, I love talking about the fact that society doesn't view death particularly very well. But just to say that Stacey Dooley is doing a programme called Inside the Undertaker next week. I think it's on Thursday evening, which she'll be fascinating. And I think she said something that clergy are well represented in it. Also, if you listen to the Nomad podcast, there's a brilliant conversation that one of the presenters has with an AI bod. So these things just open up our minds a little bit more. But I really thank you so much for being really enlightening today.
Oh, thank you.
Mark, and then Jeremy will be the last.
Thanks ever so much. I'm at the back. This is kind of working from memory a little bit, which I probably misplaced, like the lady earlier said. So in the development of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex or parts of that, which is where like empathy kind of sits, is developed almost entirely postnatally, as far as I can remember from my reading. They was like researching stuff with like Romanian orphans where they kind of been left, and they found like just massive gaps. I was just really interested when you said earlier about like the cells kind of healing themselves and things like that. Whether that's, if you're working, I used to work with young offenders, and if you're working with people who have lost that and didn't have like love early on in their thing, and that part of the brain hasn't developed in the way it should, like in through the church, through like knowing the love of God, in terms of like relationships, can that be restored, or do we have to kind of accept that, you know, them accepting a loving God is going to always be a very difficult thing, because that's missing, if you like.
Well, I think things can always be restored in the brain. The brain has the capacity, which doesn't mean it always will, or it'll do it quickly, if it does it at all. But the brain does have this capacity to restore things that it senses the lack of. But some people are not. I think your idea that somehow it comes into being after birth is a half truth. So the right ventromedial frontal cortex, which is really the area that's most important for empathy, is developed in the womb in most people. But in some people it is already deficient, and they tend to end up psychopaths. And unfortunately, most of the work that is done with psychopaths shows that whatever you do, they remain psychopaths. So that's not a very happy story. But people who have got the potential for such a cortex but have been deprived of maternal care, because it is the mother in the first 18 months of life, the gaze between the mother and the infant, that causes this area of the brain to mature and to enable one to understand this empathic relationship. which then becomes the basis for an understanding of yourself as separate from your mother, but not divorced from that person, sort of secure in the knowledge that in fact you're very strongly related to that person, but different from them. That process, which is part of how a functioning adult comes into being, can be disrupted if there isn't that early input, maternal input. But I believe it can be remedied and further generated by finding relationships with others that can be carefully nourished in the right way. You know, genetics isn't everything, but it is something. And we used to think everything was genetic, and now we think it's everything is environmental. No, neither of these is right. So we're born with genetic endowments. We have to live with what that is. But there are ways in which it can be stunted or ways in which it can be developed. And the work that you would have done would have been the developing kind of work. So thank you.
Jeremy.
Hi. Since you've been developing these very rich and wonderful ideas over many years, who would you say has been your most insightful critic?
Who has been my most insightful critic? I have to say that most of the people who have actually read my work have not ended up being critics of it. But there are people who've never read it who think they know what I say. And they are quite dangerous because they say, of course it's not like this. And I, well, of course it isn't. That isn't indeed what I believe either. I'm trying to think who's been a really helpful critic. It reflects terribly on me, but I can't actually come up with anybody. But I like engaging with people who may have... the critics and critics, aren't there? The critics who are just envious or arrogant or whatever. But there are critics who actually, you know, are very much sympathetic, but they think that I've got the weight of things wrong, and that's the kind of critic you really want. It's embarrassing. I can't really name anybody who's been particularly helpful in this respect. I'm a bit on an outside, and I'm sticking to it, and the more that I know, the more it confirms rather than disconfirms what I used to say. There's some things I said in the Master and Seminary, a couple of things where the emphasis I would now put differently.
Dr. McGilchrist, you've got some music to play to us in a moment.
Yes.
Before that, may we say thank you very, very much for your input today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. I just thought it would be nice before we leave. I know it will be a blessing by the bishop, but I just wanted you to listen to some music that I think is exquisitely beautiful and nourishing to the soul.
Dr. Ian McGilchrist, thank you so, so much for the feast that you have given us today. You have fed us well, and I hope, like me, that we're going to go away and reflect on what we have heard today, and it's not just going to be left behind, but that we will take it away with us and ask of ourselves what we might do differently or think differently about things from the new lessons that we have learned. I hope we will keep the conversations going from what we have picked up on today, and that we might even be able to build on it in future sessions that we do together. So thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. Really, really appreciated all that you have offered to us today. Neville and your team, thank you for the work. Can we give them an applause too, please? Thank you very much for the work that you've done in gathering us all together. Can someone make sure that our appreciation is also passed on to Christchurch for their hospitality? I think, I can't see who I'm, no, they're probably out. But anyway, please make sure that we pass on our appreciation for their hospitality. And for all of you, thank you for taking the time again once more for, you know, setting aside, I'm sure our diaries are all full of all sorts of things, but you made it a priority, and I appreciate that personally, that you have made this a priority. So thank you for being here today. Let's just keep a brief moment's silence before our prayers. Disturb us, O Lord, when we are too well pleased with ourselves, when our dreams have come true because we dreamed too little, because we sailed too close to the shore. Disturb us, O Lord, when with the abundance of things we possess, we've lost our thirst for the water of life. When having fallen in love with time, we have ceased to dream of eternity. And in our efforts to build a new earth, we have allowed our vision of heaven to grow dim. Stir us, O Lord, to dare more boldly, to venture into wider seas where storms show thy mastery. Where losing sight of land, we shall find the stars. In the name of him who pushed back the horizons of our hopes and invited the brave to follow. Amen. So may God, who kindled the fire of his love in the hearts of the saints, pour upon you the riches of his grace. May he give you joy in their fellowship and a share in their praises. May he strengthen you to follow them in the way of holiness and to come to the full radiance of glory. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit be upon you and remain with you and all those whom you love, pray and care for this day and always. Amen. Go in the peace of Christ. Thank you.